This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. Over the weekend, the New York Times published a news analysis entitled, "The Biden-Trump Rerun: A Nation Craving Change Gets More of the Same." This has become a constant refrain in the press. One headline after another tells us that voters don't want to have to choose between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. They don't want a rematch. Press critic Mark Jacob, a former journalist himself, noticed a problem here. As he wrote on his Substack, one of the candidates is running on an explicit set of promises to destroy American democracy, yet the press keeps calling this a rerun of 2020, almost as if this is a sporting event. This gets at something important. Wittingly or not, much of the press coverage functionally sanitizes what Trump and a good deal of his movement really represent. Mark writes about this kind of failure regularly, so we invited him on the show to discuss it. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for asking me.
First, tell us a bit about your own journalistic background and what led you to launch this Substack.
Well, I was in daily newspapering for four decades, and my last job was as metro editor at the Chicago Tribune, where I was head of the largest department in the largest newsroom in the Midwest. So it was pretty challenging. And as I saw the kind of diminishment of local news, you know, and the fact that everyone seems to be laying off people, not hiring people, I decided to ask for a buyout, got one, and became a freelance writer. And I've been, I guess you could say liberated to say what I truly feel. And I've been criticizing news media from a position of understanding how it operates, since then.
Well, we want to ask you about that in a bit. Let's go through a few other headlines. Reuters reports that the election is, quote, the rematch many Americans don't want. ABC News reports that voters, quote, don't want a Biden-Trump rematch.
Greg, the thing that really offends me is the idea of rerun, because it's, I mean, which suggests, well, it's the same stuff as 2020. We're just doing, how boring is, you're not entertaining us enough, which is a criticism I've had of the New York Times a lot, that they tend to be, they just demand to be entertained rather than, you know, trying to sort out the facts and also warn people about what is an extreme danger from, you know, right-wing extremists like Trump. And, you know, this, by calling it a rerun, it's, you're just totally misreading the situation. Here it is. In 2020 was before January 6th. So January 6th happened. So now we know that, that Trump is willing to commit violence and incite mobs and also, you know, trump up fake electors to try to, you know, to try to prevent, you know, the legal assumption of power by the person who got elected. I mean, we know he's a traitor because of January 6th. And then you have the Dobbs decision. So you know that Christian extremism, you know, fomented by Trump and Mitch McConnell, you know, stacking the Supreme Court, has managed to take away women's right to control their own bodies. And I mean, you could go over and over and over how the situation is different and more extreme now than it was 4 years ago.
Right. Another thing you could add in there is that he's being prosecuted for trying to overturn the election, and he's openly and explicitly trying to delay the trial for that until after the election so he can cancel prosecutions of himself. I mean, I think there's a big problem in the reporting of this. You often read stories that kind of describe this in the most neutral language imaginable. It basically treats it as, oh, it's just another legal strategy. That's his legal strategy. But what doesn't come through is he's trying to put himself above the law.
Right. He's trying to use everything that was designed to keep innocent people from being convicted of crimes. You know, the whole appeals process, the whole, you know, hearings, you know, making sure that the prosecutor's conduct is right. Taking every step that's tried to make our democracy fairer to regular people. And he's perverted it and exploited it in order to prevent him facing justice. And yes, I totally agree with you that news media ought to point out that his attempts to delay everything is simply an attempt to put off justice. These are not the actions of an innocent man.
Right. I do want to bear down on something else about this, which I don't know if you've touched on before, about the nature of the opposition, right? This idea that both that voters don't want either one sort of implies an equivalence between the opposition to each man. And I think this is deeply misleading. The anti-MAGA majority is a real thing. It has showed up in election after election. It was mobilized by a sense of civic emergency. We know this. We've seen lots and lots of data evidence of it. By contrast, we don't really know what the anti-Biden movement is made of. Democrats, I mean, frankly, haven't lost many elections during the Biden presidency, starting in 2020 and starting in 2018, really, when the anti-MAGA majority first really developed and became a force. So the whole implication is wrong. This idea that, that voters don't want either, just it sends a misleading picture in another way, I think, too.
I think it does, too. And I think clearly, though, I think that the anti-MAGA people, which I include myself in, have just decided that's such an overriding threat to everything we stand for, to the futures of our children, our grandchildren, that we have to coalesce and find a really practical solution to stave it off. And that means, in this case, I think it means backing a candidate who is a proven winner, who has, actually, in my opinion, overperformed in office. I'm not a big Biden supporter. I mean, I wanted Elizabeth Warren to win. I mean, Biden was almost my least favorite of the Democrats that ran, but he's the guy who won. He's the guy who could put it together, and he's to be overachieved in office. I mean, you look at what he's done with, NATO and Ukraine, and just being a grown up compared to the last guy. And so there aren't boat parades for Biden. There's not this kind of cultish following for him. These are rational people who have decided that they've got to find the best way to stave off this rise in fascism led by Trump. And if that's Biden, and I think a lot of people have decided it is Biden, that's why they're supporting him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe at the most basic level, what many of these pieces fail to do is they don't convey clearly that Trump poses a fundamental threat to the system itself, and Biden just does not.
Well, right. I mean, Greg, it's the kind of thing you can't say enough, that Trump over and over and over tells us who he is and tells us he wants to be a fascist dictator of the United States. I mean, he says it over and over. And the thing that's so frustrating to me watching the news media and their reaction to it is it's old hat to them. It's old news. They don't want to be repetitious, but you've got to be repetitious in today's world. People get little pieces of information here and there. They're not, everyone's not sitting down and watching the NBC nightly news. People are getting it from a lot of different places and they're getting snippets of it. And so you've got to repeat things. And one of the things I keep on pointing out is December 2022, Trump actually said that he wanted termination of the Constitution. He used the word termination, and there's no doubt that he said it. He put it in a Truth Social post, and the New York Times a day and a half later put it on page 13 of their newspaper. I mean, so there was this feeling that, well, it's just Trump being Trump, so who cares? And so the news media have utterly underplayed the story of a fascist attempt to take over this country and to kill democracy.
Right. In a global sense, it's clear that that's being underplayed. And I want to bring up how this sort of seeps into the coverage in all kinds of subtle ways with all sorts of weird little devices that maybe aren't intentional or whatever, but add up to something, right? So one journalistic device that's problematic is you sometimes see pieces reporting that Trump's advisors are worried about his authoritarian public statements, or that they're promising that he's going to tone it down in the general election. Now, that may or may not be true. Maybe they are worried about that, or maybe not. But reporting it that way conveys the impression that there are sane people around Trump who will kind of act as a check on his worst impulses.
Right. And that It plays into the whole Trump being Trump thing. And this is just some guy as a showman who at rallies just saying stuff. And don't worry, it's not really going to be true. And which is, and if the media buys into that, they're being conned, and they're conning their consumers, who are reading that stuff. And also this whole kind of thing of whispering behind the scenes, Greg, this whole process of the Republican Party folding to Trump and becoming, you know, part of the same horrible autocratic idea that he's been pushing. You know, we know that they don't believe that. We know that they're doing it in desperation to preserve their careers, but that makes them traitors nonetheless. And whenever I see, like, behind the scenes, people told us anonymously that we have concerns about this. You know, these private anonymous concerns by Republicans drive me nuts, because the news media shouldn't report them, because it doesn't do any good. They're not standing up for anything. They're just kind of trying to salve their consciences and pretend that the Republican Party hasn't gone to the dark side.
Right. I think that's right. It's an editorial choice to report on what those advisors are saying, and they shouldn't do it. Press critic Jay Rosen said something about one of your pieces I want to zero in on. He noted that reporters, quote, sigh a heavy sigh on behalf of voters who say they don't want either candidate, by which he meant, I think, that political journalists regularly point out that voters don't like either choice and also treat that as having inherent significance. And it sort of seems like this is a form of escapism in a way, right? The translation is, if a lot of voters don't like either candidate, well, that relieves us of the duty to inform people of the actual choice before them. The voters have spoken. One is not much worse than the other.
Yeah, well, I think that's dead on. You know, this idea that, well, we have two crappy choices. The next sentence in that mentality is, and it doesn't matter who wins. You know, and that's the thing about that New York Times story over the weekend that really drove me nuts, is the idea that, well, that it's more of the same. It's no matter who wins, it's not more of the same. Not even close. I mean, if Biden wins, you're going to have, you know, he wants to push to finally tax, you know, the super rich. He wants to really move for climate change, addressing that. I mean, there's tons of stuff. He wants to work on, reining in big pharma so they're not gouging people. There's plenty of pretty radical and, I think, positive steps that he wants to take. On the other hand, you have a candidate, Trump, who really just wants to destroy the whole system we have now and replace it with this kind of dictatorship. And that's more of the same. I mean, that New York Times headline says, a nation craving change gets more of the same. They're not going to get more of the same, no matter who wins. And so that headline and that story is just so wrong. And this is the New York Times, supposedly the leading newspaper in the country, just completely misreading the political climate.
If you're tired of hearing ads, you can support the show by becoming a member. This week, listeners of the DSR Network shows can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and early access to select podcasts. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRNetwork, one word, to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRNetwork. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 16th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
And I don't think most people know or really have a sense of just how influential those types of New York Times news analyses are. I've said this on the show before, but I want to get your take on it. I think, in fairness, there's a deep tension in a lot of the press coverage right now. News orgs are doing some extraordinary work in detailing Trump's true authoritarian intentions through reporting on his plans to unleash the DOJ on his opponents, set up giant migrant camps, and so forth. Project 25, you've read about.
Right.
And that type of thing. It's very clearly laid out in some news pieces, and there's a lot of that. And yet at the same time, those same news organizations also publish these analysis pieces that are just drained of any urgency at all in describing his intentions. And I think that might be the problem, or one of the problems. This neutral, bloodless language doesn't accurately convey the corruption, the lawlessness, and sheer malice at the core of Trump's advertised intentions. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, you know, that's, and I've had that criticism of NPR, because you know the NPR sound, you know, in the voices, you know, here we are and we're at this, you know, and I mean that is, I think that voice wouldn't change even if they were saying, "And the world is about to end because a giant meteor is about to hit the Earth." They would say it in the same kind of bloodless tone, and so they don't convey the fact that we're just in this terrible crisis that we, you know, here we are, we got like 8 months to figure out how to stop a guy from ending, you know, 2.5 centuries of American democracy. And yes, I mean, you get it in the words with the New York Times where they do this kind of cutesy language, you know, and they try to have a little fun with it. I don't want them to have fun with it. I'm not having fun with it. I think they need to panic. I think they need to show a little panic.
Okay. So you have long experience in newsrooms, right? So this is what I want to ask you on that front. To what degree is maybe the desire to kind of let people know that everything's more or less okay? You might hear a lot of alarmism about Trump out there, but look, it's really just, you know, we get how things work. We're savvy journalists. We know it's just a lot of rhetoric. To what degree is that part of the business model? The desire to make people think or feel that something is not deeply amiss?
Well, you know, you got that with Sulzberger, the New York Times guy, when he gave a speech last week, and he was in London, in Oxford, actually, and he was, you know, talking about how, you know, we're not supposed to give like alarming facts. We're supposed to give complicated facts that even if they don't, you know, go to one way or another, sometimes the truth is complicated. And sometimes the truth is complicated. And, you know, I'm perfectly willing to think that, you know, the Democrats aren't right about everything. They certainly aren't. And, you know, and when you're talking issues, when you're talking, you know, single payer healthcare or pharmaceutical prices, yeah, there's plenty of room for people to have different feelings about things. But this is different from that. This is, you know, we're 3 years away from a deadly mob attacking the U.S. Capitol. Did you think that was going to happen in your lifetime? I certainly didn't. And the fact that hardly anybody of any position of power has been held to account for it is also extremely alarming, because that just means that they get another chance later to do it. News organizations are supposed to calm people based on facts, but they're also supposed to alarm people based on facts. I mean, this is the time for them to be sounding the alarm. That's really one big part of their job. Is there's a hurricane coming, they're supposed to say, "Hey, a hurricane's coming. Maybe you need to move inland." And this is a hurricane. This is a political hurricane that's coming right at us. And the major news media are often saying, "Just relax and have another beer."
Right. And so I think some skeptics of what you and I think might say something like, "All right, Trump is using a lot of rhetoric, but he was reined in the first term, and there's a very reasonable set of scenarios by which, even if he wins, none of the sky is falling scenarios come to pass." But so what I respond to that, and I want to get your take too, is, all right, even if that's true, it still seems to be fundamentally misleading to people to not let them know that there really is some sort of danger out there, even if it's not certain to come to pass, right? As you say, he's saying all this in his own words, and it's just not breaking through in the headlines and in the news analysis pieces and in the kind of editorial choices that a lot of these news organizations are making, right?
But the only thing I would correct on that, or I would argue with, is that they're not starting from the, if they win this time, they're not starting from the same place they started last time. They've made all their mistakes. They figured out how to, you know, root out the people who would slow things up for them, the bureaucrats, the ones that they call the deep state, which is actually just dedicated bureaucrats who believe in the law. And they're not starting from that place. That Project 2025, which everyone needs to understand what that is, they're recruiting an army of federal workers now, to where on day one or in the first week, they will have all these people. They will quickly hire people who will do exactly what Trump says, whether it's legal or not. Their plans are so far more advanced now than they were at the start of Trump's first term in office.
I think there's no doubt about that. I recently reported that some polling by Democrats found that a large percentage of respondents was largely unaware of some of Trump's most explicit public statements of intent to impose authoritarian rule, like his dictator for a day threat or the one you referenced earlier, the vague threat to inflict termination to provisions of the Constitution, or the immigrants poison the blood of our country, quote. I think David Roberts put it really well somewhere. He said that if voters are reporting such little awareness of things of such overwhelming importance, perhaps journalists should ask themselves if something is wrong and set themselves the task of fixing it. Now, again, to go back to your experience in newsrooms, to what degree do journalists genuinely believe they have a duty to inform? My sense is that as a profession, in a general sense, journalists are not good at self-criticism on this front. What's your experience?
They're not good at self-awareness. I mean, they're not. I do think, in fact, I know just from my experience in newsrooms that most of the journalists I worked with, at least, felt like they were working for the public. I know I always did. I felt I had to deal with my bosses. I had to try to please my bosses. I had to, you know, do all that stuff. But my main duty, in my opinion, was to the public. It was to the people who were reading my newspaper, and I was supposed to do the best job I could for them. So I do think that the thing is, it's tough, Greg, when you like me and you're criticizing, you know, mainstream media a lot, it makes it seem, you know, people will respond to my tweets and stuff and say, yeah, we should, they all stink, they're all terrible, or you know, well, I'm going to cancel my subscription. And I'm not saying that. I mean, I think a lot of journalists try really hard to do the right thing. I think there's a lot of conditions that go against them. There's, you know, for example, on TV, there's real pressure to have live interviews with these, you know, proven liars, you know, like Elise Stefanik. I mean, you put Elise Stefanik on the air live, it's a guarantee that she's going to lie more often than you can correct her. So she's going to win. And so a lot of the structures of journalism, the way it's being done these days, really are exploited by the Republicans. They are very good at that.
Yeah, I do think they really have kind of hacked the discourse in a way. And I also think there's a broader sanitization of MAGA going on. I mean, like I said earlier, this seeps in so many different ways. So the Times recently had a news analysis piece that described Trump's threat to abandon NATO countries to Russia as a kind of revival of a real doctrine of isolationism. It's like it's never suggested, never raised as a legitimate question that perhaps Trump and his movement want a Putin victory because right. They see his form of authoritarian nationalism as preferable to liberal democracy. I mean, you wrote about this. He just met with Hungary's Viktor Orban, and clearly he's allying himself with a kind of axis of far-right nationalist dictators. And clearly, a Trump victory would align the U.S. with those international forces. And when you read bloodless language about him being an isolationist, a reader would just not have the faintest clue what's actually going on.
Well, you know, the thing is, they're giving Trump too much credit. They're giving him credit for having a philosophy. I don't think he has, you know, it's that he wants isolationism or what, you know, whatever. No, the best way to look at Trump is as a mob boss, and he's going to do whatever is best for him. I mean, and I don't think he cares whether, you know, Putin wins in Ukraine, except to the extent that Putin will help him. If he helps undermine Ukraine, then Putin will be more grateful to Trump and will help him. And considering the whole track record of everyone, you know, I would expect Russian interference in this election.
Last question. Again, as someone who's been in newsrooms, what can people really do here, right? I think in a general sense, the journalistic profession oddly tends to process criticism from its most loyal customers, like the customers who really share the profession's small L liberal values. They process this, I'm talking about liberal readers. They process this criticism as a sign that they're doing something right. If they're getting criticized by liberals, then, well, they must be being even-handed. And I, what's your sense of how readers and news consumers can actually be heard in a constructive way by newsroom leaders?
Well, I've actually seen it lately. You know, the New York Times is rewriting its headlines a lot. And I think that they're seeing, you know, people are, like me are jumping on them, you know, very quickly for their horrible headlines. And their headlines are horrible. Their headlines are so cowardly. They never get to the point of things. They always like try to get mushy so that nobody criticizes them. And then they're sometimes just flat wrong. And they, like with the Katie Britt thing, they couldn't decide whether it was misleading or not wholly accurate or whatever the language they used. And, but they went through, I counted it, they went through six different headlines on that story over a day's time. And I think that the reason, on social media, loud criticism is getting to them a little bit. So, I mean, just a little bit. I mean, they would say no, but I think it is. Because you do see things changing. The same thing with the profile of Mark Robinson, the extremely out of his mind Republican nominee for North Carolina governor. You know, they were calling him a firebrand and a fiery outsider and stuff like that. And people like me said, that's ridiculous. The guy's a Holocaust denier. I mean, the guy wants to, he calls gay people filth. And you know, put that in the headline, please. And they did, they actually rewrote that their approach to that story. They went through and tried to do a repair job on that story. And so I think the pressure helps a little bit. I mean, but the thing that people can really do, regular people, is they got to talk to their family and friends, and they got to tell them what's happening here, and they got to find the persuadables among the people they know, and they've got to persuade them, and they've got to, and it's also in every election, it's a turnout election, so people got to care. You know, they can't turn off and decide that it doesn't matter who wins, which is that's another thing about that was to me was so damaging about that New York Times headline, is it just kind of made, oh, it's just two of those same old geezers, we don't care. People have to care this time. This is the time to care. You're going to care deeply 3 years from now if Trump wins, and it'll be too damn late.
Well, I think I hear some shreds of optimism in there somewhere. on that note, Mark Jacob, thanks so much for coming on with us. Let's hope that the criticism makes a difference.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.